toward him which, on Carrie's part, we have seen. She might have been said to be imagining herself in love when she was not. Women frequently do this. It flows from the fact that in each exists a bias toward affection, a craving for the pleasure of being loved. The longing to be shielded, bettered, sympathized with, is one of the attributes of the sex. This, coupled with sentiment and a natural tendency to emotion, often makes refusing difficult. It persuades them that they are in love. Once at home, she changed her clothes and straightened the rooms for herself. In the matter of the arrangement of the furniture, she never took the housemaid's opinion. That young woman invariably put one of the rocking chairs in the corner, and Carrie, as regularly, moved it out. Today she hardly noticed that it was in the wrong place, so absorbed was she in her own thoughts. She worked about the room until Drouet put in appearance at 5 o'clock. The drummer was flushed and excited and full of determination to know all about her relations with Hurstwood. Nevertheless, after going over the subject in his mind the livelong day, he was rather weary of it and wished it over with. He did not foresee serious consequences of any sort, and yet he rather hesitated to begin. Carrie was sitting by the window when he came in, rocking and looking out. "Well," she said innocently, weary of her own mental discussion and wondering at his haste and ill-concealed excitement, "what makes you hurry so?" Drouet hesitated, now that he was in her presence, uncertain as to what course to pursue. He was no diplomat. He could neither read nor see. "When did you get home?" he asked foolishly. "Oh, an hour or so ago." "What makes you ask that?" "You weren't here," he said, "when I came back this morning, and I thought you had gone out."
"So I did," said Carrie simply. "I went for a walk."
Drouet looked at her wonderingly. For all his lack of dignity in such matters, he did not know where to begin. He stared at her in the most flagrant manner until at last she said, "What makes you stare at me so? What's the matter?"
"Nothing," he answered. "I was just thinking."
"Just thinking what?" she returned smilingly, puzzled by his attitude.
"Oh, nothing. Nothing much."
"Well, then, what makes you look so?" Drouet was standing by the dresser, gazing at her in a comic manner. He had laid off his hat and gloves and was now fidgeting with the little toilet pieces which were nearest him. He hesitated to believe that the pretty woman before him was involved in anything so unsatisfactory to himself. He was very much inclined to feel that it was all right, after all. Yet the knowledge imparted to him by the chambermaid was rankling in his mind. He wanted to plunge in with a straight remark of some sort, but he knew not what.
"Where did you go this morning?" he finally asked, weakly.
"Why, I went for a walk," said Carrie.
"Sure you did?" he asked.
"Yes. What makes you ask?" She was beginning to see now that he knew something. Instantly she drew herself into a more reserved position. Her cheeks blanched slightly.
"I thought maybe you didn't," he said, beating about the bush in the most useless manner.
Carrie gazed at him, and as she did so, her ebbing courage halted. She saw that he himself was hesitating, and with a woman's intuition realized that there was no occasion for great alarm.
"What makes you talk like that?" she asked, wrinkling her pretty forehead. "You act so funny tonight."
"I feel funny," he answered. They looked at one another for a moment, and then Drouet plunged desperately into his subject.
"What's this about you and Hurstwood?" he asked.
"Me and Hurstwood? What do you mean?"
"Didn't he come here 12 times while I was away?"
12 times, repeated Carrie guiltily.
"No, but what do you mean?"
"Somebody said that you went out riding with him and that he came here every night."
"No such thing," answered Carrie. "It isn't true. Who told you that?"
She was blushing scarlet to the roots of her hair, but Drouet did not catch the full hue of her face, owing to the modified light of the room. He was regaining much confidence as Carrie defended herself with denials.
Well, someone, he said. You're sure you didn't?
Certainly, said Carrie. You know how often he came.
Drouet paused for a moment and thought.
I know what you told me, he said finally.
He moved nervously about while Carrie looked at him confusedly.
Well, I know that I didn't tell you any such thing as that, said Carrie, recovering herself.
If I were you, went on Drouet, ignoring her last remark, I wouldn't have anything to do with him. He's a married man, you know.
Who is? Said Carrie, stumbling at the word.
Why, Hurstwood, said Drouet, noting the effect and feeling that he was delivering a telling blow.
Hurstwood! Exclaimed Carrie, rising.
Her face had changed several shades since this announcement was made. She looked within and without herself in a half-dazed way.
Who told you this?
She asked, forgetting that her interest was out of order and exceedingly incriminating.
Why, I know it. I've always known it, said Drouet.
Carrie was feeling about for a right thought. She was making a most miserable showing, and yet feelings were generating within her which were anything but crumbling cowardice.
I thought I told you, he added.
No, you didn't, she contradicted, suddenly recovering her voice. You didn't do anything of the kind. Drouet listened to her in astonishment. This was something new.
I thought I did, he said.
Carrie looked around her very solemnly and then went over to the window.
You oughtn't to have had anything to do with him, said Drouet in an injured tone, after all I've done for you.
You, said Carrie.
You? What have you done for me?
Her little brain had been surging with contradictory feelings. Shame at exposure, shame at Hurstwood's perfidy, anger at Drouet's deception, the mockery he had made of her. Now one clear idea came into her head. He was at fault. There was no doubt about it. Why did he bring Hurstwood out? Hurstwood, a married man, and never say a word to her. Never mind now about Hurstwood's perfidy. Why had he done this? Why hadn't he warned her? There he stood now, guilty of this miserable breach of confidence and talking about what he had done for her. Well, I like that, exclaimed Drouet, little realizing the fire his remark had generated.
I think I've done a good deal.
You have, eh? She answered.
You've deceived me, that's what you've done. You've brought your old friends out here under false pretenses. You've made me out to be...
Oh... And with this her voice broke, and she pressed her two little hands together tragically.
"I don't see what that's got to do with it," said the drummer quaintly.
"No," she answered, recovering herself and shutting her teeth.
"No, of course you don't see. There isn't anything you see. You couldn't have told me in the first place, could you? You had to make me out wrong until it was too late. Now you come sneaking around here with your information and your talk about what you have done."
Drouet had never suspected this side of Carrie's nature. She was alive with feeling, her eyes snapping, her lips quivering, her whole body sensible of the injury she felt and partaking of her wrath.
"Who's sneaking?" he asked, mildly conscious of error on his part, but certain that he was wronged. "You are," stamped Carrie. "You're a horrid, conceited coward, that's what you are. If you had any sense of manhood in you, you wouldn't have thought of doing any such thing."
The drummer stared.
"I'm not a coward," he said. "What do you mean by going with other men anyway?"
"Other men," exclaimed Carrie. "Other men? You know better than that. I did go with Mr. Hurstwood, but whose fault was it? Didn't you bring him here? You told him yourself that he should come out here and take me out. Now, after it's all over, you come and tell me that I oughtn't to go with him and that he's a married man."
She paused at the sound of the two last words and wrung her hands. The knowledge of Hurstwood's perfidy wounded her like a knife.
"Oh," she sobbed, repressing herself wonderfully and keeping her eyes dry.
"Oh, oh."
"Well, I didn't think you'd be running around with him while I was away," insisted Drouet.
"Didn't think," said Carrie, now angered to the core by the man's peculiar attitude.
"Of course not. You thought only of what would be to your satisfaction. You thought you'd make a toy of me, a plaything. Well, I'll show you that you won't. I'll have nothing more to do with you at all. You can take your old things and keep them.
And unfastening a little pin he had given her, she flung it vigorously upon the floor and began to move about as if to gather up the things which belonged to her. By this, Drouet was not only irritated, but fascinated the more. He looked at her in amazement, and finally said, "I don't see where your wrath comes in. I've got the right of this thing. You oughtn't to have done anything that wasn't right after all I did for you."
"What have you done for me?" asked Carrie, blazing, her head thrown back and her lips parted.
"I think I've done a good deal," said the drummer, looking around. "I've given you all the clothes you wanted, haven't I? I've taken you everywhere you wanted to go. You've had as much as I've had, and more, too."
Carrie was not ungrateful, whatever else might be said of her. Insofar as her mind could construe, she acknowledged benefits received. She hardly knew how to answer this, and yet her wrath was not placated. She felt that the drummer had injured her irreparably.
"Did I ask you to?" she returned.
"Well, I did it," said Drouet, "and you took it."
"You talk as though I had persuaded you," answered Carrie. "You stand there and throw up what you've done. I don't want your old things. I'll not have them. You take them tonight and do what you please with them. I'll not stay here another minute."
"That's nice," he answered, becoming angered now at the sense of his own approaching loss.
"Use everything and abuse me and then walk off. That's just like a woman. I take you when you haven't got anything, and then when someone else comes along, why, I'm no good. I always thought it'd come out that way."
He felt really hurt as he thought of his treatment, and looked as if he saw no way of obtaining justice.
"It's not so," said Carrie, "and I'm not going with anybody else. You have been as miserable and inconsiderate as you can be. I hate you, I tell you, and I wouldn't live with you another minute. You're a big, insulting—"
Here she hesitated and used no word at all.
"Oh, you wouldn't talk that way."
She had secured her hat and jacket and slipped the latter on over her little evening dress. Some wisps of wavy hair had loosened from the bands at the side of her head and were straggling over her hot red cheeks. She was angry, mortified, grief-stricken. Her large eyes were full of the anguish of tears, but her lids were not yet wet. She was distracted and uncertain, deciding and doing things without an aim or conclusion, and she had not the slightest conception of how the whole difficulty would end.
"Well, that's a fine finish," said Drouet. "Pack up and pull out, eh? You take the cake. I bet you were knocking around with Hurstwood, or you wouldn't act like that. I don't want the old rooms. You needn't pull out for me. You can have them for all I care. But, George, you haven't done me right."
"I'll not live with you," said Carrie. "I don't want to live with you. You've done nothing but brag around ever since you've been here."
"Oh, I haven't done anything of the kind," he answered.
Carrie walked over to the door.
"Where are you going?" he said, stepping over and heading her off.
"Let me out," she said.
"Where are you going?" he repeated.
He was, above all, sympathetic, and the sight of Carrie wandering out, he knew not where, affected him, despite his grievance. Carrie merely pulled at the door. The strain of the situation was too much for her, however. She made one more vain effort and then burst into tears.
"Now, be reasonable, Cad," said Drouet gently. "What do you want to rush out for this way? You haven't any place to go. Why not stay here now and be quiet? I'll not bother you. I don't want to stay here any longer."
Carrie had gone sobbing from the door to the window. She was so overcome she could not speak.
"Be reasonable now," he said. "I don't want to hold you. You can go if you want to, but why don't you think it over? Lord knows I don't want to stop you."
He received no answer. Carrie was quieting, however, under the influence of his plea.
"You stay here now and I'll go," he added at last.
Carrie listened to this with mingled feelings. Her mind was shaken loose from the little mooring of logic that it had.
She was stirred by this thought, angered by that, her own injustice, Hurstwood's, Drouet's, their respective qualities of kindness and favor, the threat of the world outside, in which she had failed once before, the impossibility of this state inside, where the chambers were no longer justly hers, the effect of the argument upon her nerves, all combined to make her a mass of jangling fibers, an anchorless, storm-beaten little craft which could do absolutely nothing but drift. "Say," said Drouet, coming over to her after a few moments, with a new idea, and putting his hand upon her. "Don't," said Carrie, drawing away, but not removing her handkerchief from her eyes. "Never mind about this quarrel now. Let it go. You stay here until the month's out anyhow, and then you can tell better what you want to do. Eh?" Carrie made no answer. "You'd better do that," he said. "There's no use you packing up now. You can't go anywhere." Still, he got nothing for his words. "If you'll do that, we'll call it off for the present, and I'll get out." Carrie lowered her handkerchief slightly and looked out of the window. "Will you do that?" he asked. Still no answer. "Will you?" he repeated. She only looked vaguely into the street. "Aw, come on," he said. "Tell me. Will you?"
"I don't know,"
said Carrie softly, forced to answer. "Promise me you'll do that," he said, "and we'll quit talking about it. It'll be the best thing for you." Carrie heard him, but she could not bring herself to answer reasonably. She felt that the man was gentle, and that his interest in her had not abated, and it made her suffer a pang of regret. She was in a most helpless plight. As for Drouet, his attitude had been that of the jealous lover. Now his feelings were a mixture of anger at deception, sorrow at losing Carrie, misery at being defeated. He wanted his rights in some way or other, and yet his rights included the retaining of Carrie, the making her feel her error. "Will you?" he urged.
"Well, I'll see," said Carrie.
This left the matter as open as before, but it was something. It looked as if the quarrel would blow over, if they could only get some way of talking to one another. Carrie was ashamed and Drouet aggrieved. He pretended to take up the task of packing some things into a valise. Now, as Carrie watched him out of the corner of her eye, certain sound thoughts came into her head. He had erred, true, but what had she done? He was kindly and good-natured for all his egotism. Throughout this argument, he had said nothing very harsh. On the other hand, there was Hurstwood, a greater deceiver than he. He had pretended all this affection, all this passion, and he was lying to her all the while. Oh, the perfidy of men! And she had loved him. There could be nothing more in that quarter. She would see Hurstwood no more. She would write him and let him know what she thought. Thereupon, what would she do? Here were these rooms. Here was Drouet, pleading for her to remain. Evidently, things could go on here somewhat as before, if all were arranged. It would be better than the street, without a place to lay her head. All this she thought of as Drouet rummaged the drawers for collars and labored long and painstakingly at finding a shirt stud. He was in no hurry to rush this matter. He felt an attraction to Carrie which would not down. He could not think that the thing would end by his walking out of the room. There must be some way round, some way to make her own up that he was right and she was wrong, to patch up a peace and shut out Hurstwood forever. Mercy, how he turned at the man's shameless duplicity. "Do you think," he said after a few moments' silence, "that you'll try and get on the stage?" He was wondering what she was intending.
"I don't know what I'll do yet," said Carrie.
"If you do, maybe I can help you. I've got a lot of friends in that line." She made no answer to this. "Don't go and try to knock around now without any money. Let me help you," he said. "It's no easy thing to go on your own hook here."
Carrie only rocked back and forth in her chair. I don't want you to go up against a hard game that way. He bestirred himself about some other details, and Carrie rocked on. Why don't you tell me all about this thing, he said after a time, and let's call it off. You don't really care for Hurstwood, do you? Why do you want to start on that again, said Carrie. You were to blame. No, I wasn't, he answered. Yes, you were too, said Carrie. You shouldn't have ever told me such a story as that. But you didn't have much to do with him, did you? Went on Drouet, anxious for his own peace of mind to get some direct denial from her. I won't talk about it, said Carrie, pained at the quizzical turn the peace arrangement had taken. What's the use of acting like that now, Cad? Insisted the drummer, stopping in his work and putting up a hand expressively. You might let me know where I stand, at least. I won't, said Carrie, feeling no refuge but in anger. Whatever has happened is your own fault. Then you do care for him, said Drouet, stopping completely and experiencing a rush of feeling. Oh, stop, said Carrie. Well, I'll not be made a fool of, exclaimed Drouet. You may trifle around with him if you want to, but you can't lead me. You can tell me or not, just as you want to, but I won't fool any longer. He shoved the last few remaining things he had laid out into his valise and snapped it with a vengeance. Then he grabbed his coat, which he had laid off to work, picked up his gloves, and started out. You can go to the deuce as far as I am concerned, he said as he reached the door. I'm no sucker. And with that he opened it with a jerk and closed it equally vigorously. Carrie listened at her window view, more astonished than anything else at this sudden rise of passion in the drummer. She could hardly believe her senses. So good-natured and tractable had he invariably been. It was not for her to see the wellspring of human passion. A real flame of love is a subtle thing. It burns as a will-o'-the-wisp, dancing onward to fairy lands of delight. It roars as a furnace. Too often, jealousy is the quality upon which it feeds. 24. Ashes of Tinder, a face at the window. That night Hurstwood remained downtown entirely, going to the Palmer House for a bed after his work was through. He was in a fevered state of mind, owing to the blight his wife's action threatened to cast upon his entire future. While he was not sure how much significance might be attached to the threat she had made, he was sure that her attitude, if long continued, would cause him no end of trouble. She was determined and had worsted him in a very important contest. How would it be from now on? He walked the floor of his little office, and later that of his room, putting one thing and another together to no avail. Mrs. Hurstwood, on the contrary, had decided not to lose her advantage by inaction. Now that she had practically cowed him, she would follow up her work with demands, the acknowledgement of which would make her word law in the future. He would have to pay her the money which she would now regularly demand, or there would be trouble. It did not matter what he did. She really did not care whether he came home any more or not. The household would move along much more pleasantly without him, and she could do as she wished without consulting anyone. Now she was proposed to consult a lawyer and hire a detective. She would find out at once just what advantages she could gain. Hurstwood walked the floor, mentally arranging the chief points of his situation. She has all that property in her name, he kept saying to himself. What a fool trick that was. Curse it! What a fool move that was. He also thought of his managerial position. If she raises a row now, I'll lose this thing. They won't have me around if my name gets in the papers. My friends, too. He grew more angry as he thought of the talk any action on her part would create. How would the papers talk about it? Every man he knew would be wondering. He would have to explain and deny and make a general mark of himself. Then Moy would come and confer with him, and there would be the devil to pay. Many little wrinkles gathered between his eyes as he contemplated this, and his brow moistened. He saw no solution of anything, not a loophole left.
Through all this, thoughts of Carrie flashed upon him and the approaching affair of Saturday. Tangled as all his matters were, he did not worry over that. It was the one pleasing thing in this whole rout of trouble. He could arrange that satisfactorily, for Carrie would be glad to wait, if necessary. He would see how things turned out tomorrow, and then he would talk to her. They were going to meet as usual. He saw only her pretty face and neat figure, and wondered why life was not arranged so that such joy as he found with her could be steadily maintained. How much more pleasant it would be. Then he would take up his wife's thread again, and the wrinkles and moisture would return. In the morning he came over from the hotel and opened his mail, but there was nothing in it outside the ordinary run. For some reason he felt as if something might come that way, and was relieved when all the envelopes had been scanned and nothing suspicious noticed. He began to feel the appetite that had been wanting before he had reached the office, and decided, before going out to the park to meet Carrie, to drop in at the Grand Pacific and have a pot of coffee and some rolls. While the danger had not lessened, it had not as yet materialized, and with him, no news was good news. If he could only get plenty of time to think, perhaps something would turn up. Surely this thing would not drift along to catastrophe and he not find a way out. His spirits fell, however, when, upon reaching the park, he waited and waited, and Carrie did not come. He held his favorite post for an hour or more, then arose and began to walk about restlessly. Could something have happened out there to keep her away? Could she have been reached by his wife? Surely not. So little did he consider Drouet that it never once occurred to him to worry about his finding out. He grew restless as he ruminated, and then decided that perhaps it was nothing. She had not been able to get away this morning. That was why no letter notifying him had come. He would get one today. It would probably be on his desk when he got back. He would look for it at once. After a time, he gave up waiting and drearily headed for the Madison car. To add to his distress, the bright blue sky became overcast with little fleecy clouds which shut out the sun. The wind veered to the east, and by the time he reached his office it was threatening to drizzle all afternoon. He went in and examined his letters, but there was nothing from Carrie. Fortunately, there was nothing from his wife either. He thanked his stars that he did not have to confront that proposition just now when he needed to think so much. He walked the floor again, pretending to be in an ordinary mood, but secretly troubled beyond the expression of words. At 1:30 he went to Rector's for lunch, and when he returned a messenger was waiting for him. He looked at the little chap with a feeling of doubt. "I'm to bring an answer," said the boy. Hurstwood recognized his wife's writing. She tore it open and read without a show of feeling. It began in the most formal manner, and was sharply and coldly worded throughout. "I want you to send the money I asked for at once. I need it to carry out my plans. You can stay away if you want to. It doesn't matter in the least, but I must have some money. So don't delay, but send it by the boy." When he had finished it, he stood holding it in his hands. The audacity of the thing took his breath. It roused his ire also, the deepest element of revolt in him. His first impulse was to write but four words in reply, "Go to the devil!" But he compromised by telling the boy that there would be no reply. Then he sat down in his chair and gazed without seeing, contemplating the result of his work. What would she do about that, the confounded wretch? Was she going to try to bulldoze him into submission? He would go up there and have it out with her, that's what he would do. She was carrying things with too high a hand. These were his first thoughts. Later, however, his old discretion asserted itself. Something had to be done. A climax was near, and she would not sit by idle. He knew her well enough to know that when she had decided upon a plan, she would follow it up. Possibly matters would go into a lawyer's hands at once. "Damn her," he said softly, with his teeth firmly set. "I'll make her change her tone if I have to use force to do it." He arose from his chair and went and looked out into the street. The long drizzle had begun. Pedestrians had turned up collars and trousers at the bottom. Hands were hidden in the pockets of the umbrellas. Umbrellas were up. The street looked like a sea of round black cloth roofs, twisting, bobbing, moving. Trucks and vans were rattling in a noisy line, and everywhere men were shielding themselves as best they could. He scarcely noticed the picture. He was forever confronting his wife, demanding of her to change her attitude toward him before he worked her bodily harm. At 4 o'clock, another note came, which simply said that if the money was not forthcoming that evening, the matter would be laid before Fitzgerald and Moy on the morrow, and other steps would be taken to get it. Hurstwood almost exclaimed out loud at the insistency of this thing. Yes, he would send her the money. He'd take it to her. He would go up there and have a talk with her, and that at once. He put on his hat and looked around for his umbrella. He would have some arrangement of this thing. He called a cab and was driven through the dreary rain to the north side. On the way, his temper cooled as he thought of the details of the case. What did she know? What had she done? Maybe she'd got hold of Carrie, who knows, or Drouet. Perhaps she really had evidence and was prepared to fell him as a man does another from secret ambush. She was shrewd. Why should she taunt him this way unless she had good grounds? He began to wish that he had compromised in some way or other, that he had sent the money. Perhaps he could do it up here. He would go in and see, anyhow. He would have no row. By the time he reached his own street, he was keenly alive to the difficulties of his situation and wished over and over that some solution would offer itself, that he could see his way out. He alighted and went up the steps to the front door, but it was with a nervous palpitation of the heart. He pulled out his key and tried to insert it, but another key was on the inside. He shook at the knob, but the door was locked. Then he rang the bell. No answer. He rang again, this time harder. Still no answer. He jangled it fiercely several times in succession, but without avail. Then he went below. There was a door which opened under the steps into the kitchen, protected by an iron grating, intended as a safeguard against burglars. When he reached this, he noticed that it also was bolted, and that the kitchen windows were down. What could it mean? He rang the bell and then waited. Finally, seeing that no one was coming, he turned and went back to his cab. "I guess they're gone out," he said apologetically to the individual who was hiding his red face in a loose tarpaulin raincoat. "I saw a young girl up in that winder," returned the cabbie. Hurstwood looked, but there was no face there now. He climbed moodily into the cab, relieved and distressed. So this was the game, was it? Shut him out and make him pay. Well, by the Lord, that did beat all. 25. Ashes of tinder. The loosing of stays. When Hurstwood got back to his office again, he was in a greater quandary than ever. Lord, Lord, he thought, what had he got into? How could things have taken such a violent turn, and so quickly? He could hardly realize how it had all come about. It seemed a monstrous, unnatural, unwarranted condition which had suddenly descended upon him without his let or hindrance. Meanwhile, he gave a thought now and then to Carrie. What could be the trouble in that quarter? No letter had come, no word of any kind, and yet here it was late in the evening, and she had agreed to meet him that morning. Tomorrow they were to have met and gone off. Where? He saw that in the excitement of recent events he had not formulated a plan upon that score. He was desperately in love, and would have taken great chances to win her under ordinary circumstances, but now... Now what? Supposing she had found out something. Supposing she, too, wrote him and told him that she knew all, that she would have nothing more to do with him. It would be just like this to happen as things were going now. Meanwhile, he had not sent the money. He strolled up and down the polished floor of the resort, his hands in his pockets, his brow wrinkled, his mouth set. He was getting some vague comfort out of a good cigar, but it was no panacea for the ill which affected him. Every once in a while he would clench his fingers and tap his foot, signs of the stirring mental processes he was undergoing. His whole nature was vigorously and powerfully shaken up, and he was finding what limits the mind has to endurance. He drank more brandy and soda than he had any evening in months. He was altogether a fine example of great mental perturbation. For all his study, nothing came of the evening except this. He sent the money. It was with great opposition, after 2 or 3 hours of the most urgent mental affirmation and denial, that at last he got an envelope, placed in it the requested amount, and slowly sealed it up. Then he called Harry, the boy of all work around the place. "You take this to this address," he said, handing him the envelope, "and give it to Mrs. Hurstwood."
"Yes, sir," said the boy.
"If she isn't there, bring it back."
"Yes, sir."
"You've seen my wife?" he asked, as a precautionary measure, as the boy turned to go.
"Oh, yes, sir. I know her."
"All right, now. Hurry right back."
"Any answer?"
"I guess not." The boy hastened away, and the manager fell to his musings. Now he had done it. There was no use speculating over that. He was beaten for tonight, and he might just as well make the best of it. But oh, the wretchedness of being forced this way. He could see her meeting the boy at the door and smiling sardonically. She would take the envelope and know that she had triumphed. If only he had that letter back, he wouldn't send it. He breathed heavily and wiped the moisture from his face. For relief, he arose and joined in conversation with the few friends who were drinking. He tried to get the interest of things about him, but it was not to be. All the time his thoughts would run out to his home and see the scene being therein enacted. All the time he was wondering what she would say when the boy handed her the envelope. In about 1 hour and 3 quarters, the boy returned. He had evidently delivered the package, for as he came up, he made no sign of taking anything out of his pocket.
"Well," said Hurstwood. "I gave it to her."
"My wife?"
"Yes, sir."
"Any answer?"
"She said it was high time."
Hurstwood scowled fiercely. There was no more to be done upon that score that night. He went on brooding over his situation until midnight, when he repaired again to the Palmer House. He wondered what the morning would bring forth, and slept anything but soundly upon it. Next day he went again to the office and opened his mail, suspicious and hopeful of its contents. No word from Carrie. Nothing from his wife, which was pleasant. The fact that he had sent the money and that she had received it worked to the ease of his mind, for as the thought that he had done it receded, his chagrin at it grew less and his hope of peace more. He fancied, as he sat at his desk, that nothing would be done for 1 or 2 weeks. Meanwhile, he would have time to think. This process of thinking began by a reversion to Carrie and the arrangement by which he was to get her away from Drouet. How about that now? His pain at her failure to meet or write him rapidly increased as he devoted himself to this subject. He decided to write her care of the West Side Post Office and ask for an explanation, as well as to have her meet him. The thought that this letter would probably not reach her until Monday chafed him exceedingly. He must get some speedier method. But how? He thought upon it for 30 minutes, not contemplating a messenger or a cab direct to the house, owing to the exposure of it, but finding that time was slipping away to no purpose, he wrote the letter and then began to think again. The hours slipped by, and with them the possibility of the union he had contemplated. He had thought to be joyously aiding Carrie by now in the task of joining her interests to his, and here it was afternoon and nothing done. 3 o'clock came, 4, 5, 6, and no letter. The helpless manager paced the floor and grimly endured the gloom of defeat. He saw a busy Saturday ushered out, the Sabbath in, and nothing done.
All day, the bar being closed, he brooded alone, shut out from home, from the excitement of his resort, from Carrie, and without the ability to alter his condition one iota. It was the worst Sunday he had spent in his life. In Monday's second mail, he encountered a very legal-looking letter which held his interest for some time. It bore the imprint of the law offices of McGregor, James, and Hay, and with a very formal "Dear Sir," and we beg to state, went on to inform him briefly that they had been retained by Mrs. Julia Hurstwood to adjust certain matters which related to her sustenance and property rights, and would he kindly call and see them about the matter at once. He read it through carefully several times, and then merely shook his head. It seemed as if his family troubles were just beginning.
"Well," he said after a time, quite audibly, "I don't know."
Then he folded it up and put it in his pocket. To add to his misery, there was no word from Carrie. He was quite certain now that she knew he was married and was angered at his perfidy. His loss seemed all the more bitter now that he needed her most. He thought he would go out and insist on seeing her if she did not send him word of some sort soon. He was really affected most miserably of all by this desertion. He had loved her earnestly enough, but now that the possibility of losing her stared him in the face, she seemed much more attractive. He really pined for a word and looked out upon her with his mind's eye in the most wistful manner. He did not propose to lose her, whatever she might think. Come what might, he would adjust this matter, and soon. He would go to her and tell her all his family complications. He would explain to her just where he stood and how much he needed her. Surely she couldn't go back on him now. It wasn't possible. He would plead until her anger would melt, until she would forgive him. Suddenly he thought, supposing she isn't out there? Suppose she is gone? He was forced to take his feet. It was too much to think of and sit still. Nevertheless, his rousing availed him nothing. On Tuesday it was the same way. He did manage to bring himself into the mood to go out to Carrie, but when he got in Ogden Place, he thought he saw a man watching him and went away. He did not go within a block of the house. One of the galling incidents of this visit was that he came back on a Randolph Street car and, without noticing, arrived almost opposite the building of the concern with which his son was connected. This sent a pang through his heart. He had called on his boy there several times. Now the lad had not sent him a word. His absence did not seem to be noticed by either of his children. Well, well. Fortune plays a man queer tricks. He got back to his office and joined in a conversation with friends. It was as if idle chatter deadened the sense of misery. That night he dined at Rector's and returned at once to his office. In the bustle and show of the latter was his only relief. He troubled over many little details and talked perfunctorily to everybody. He stayed at his desk long after all the others had gone, and only quitted it when the night watchman on his round pulled at the front door to see if it was safely locked. On Wednesday he received another polite note from McGregor, James, and Hay. It read, "Dear Sir, we beg to inform you that we are instructed to wait until tomorrow, Thursday, at 1 o'clock, before filing suit against you on behalf of Mrs. Julia Hurstwood for divorce and alimony. If we do not hear from you before that time, we shall consider that you do not wish to compromise the matter in any way and act accordingly. Very truly yours, etc."
"Compromise," exclaimed Hurstwood bitterly. "Compromise."
Again he shook his head. So here it was, spread out clear before him, and now he knew what to expect. If he didn't go and see them, they would sue him promptly. If he did, he would be offered terms that would make his blood boil. He folded the letter and put it with the other one. Then he put on his hat and went for a turn about the block. XXVI. The Ambassador Fallen. A Search for the Gate.
Carrie, left alone by Drouet, listened to his retreating steps, scarcely realizing what had happened. She knew that he had stormed out. It was some moments before she questioned whether he would return, not now exactly, but ever. She looked around her upon the rooms, out of which the evening light was dying, and wondered why she did not feel quite the same toward them. She went over to the dresser and struck a match, lighting the gas. Then she went back to the rocker to think. It was some time before she could collect her thoughts, but when she did, this truth began to take on importance. She was quite alone. Suppose Drouet did not come back. Suppose she should never hear anything more of him. This fine arrangement of chambers would not last long. She would have to quit them. To her credit, be it said, she never once counted on Hurstwood. She could only approach that subject with a pang of sorrow and regret. For a truth, she was rather shocked and frightened by this evidence of human depravity. He would have tricked her without turning an eyelash. She would have been led into a newer and worse situation. And yet she could not keep out the picture of his looks and manners. Only this one deed seemed strange and miserable. It contrasted sharply with all she felt and knew concerning the man. But she was alone. That was the greater thought just at present. How about that? Would she go out to work again? Would she begin to look around in the business district? The stage! Oh, yes. Drouet had spoken about that. Was there any hope there? She moved to and fro in deep and varied thoughts while the minutes slipped away and night fell completely. She had had nothing to eat, and yet there she sat, thinking it over. She remembered that she was hungry and went to the little cupboard in the rear room where were the remains of one of their breakfasts. She looked at these things with certain misgivings. The contemplation of food had more significance than usual. While she was eating, she began to wonder how much money she had. It struck her as exceedingly important, and without ado she went to look for her purse. It was on the dresser, and in it were $7 in bills and some change. She quailed as she thought of the insignificance of the amount, and rejoiced because the rent was paid until the end of the month. She began also to think what she would have done if she had gone out into the street when she first started. By the side of that situation, as she looked at it now, the present seemed agreeable. She had a little time, at least, and then, perhaps, everything would come out all right after all. Drouet had gone, but what of it? He did not seem seriously angry. He only acted as if he were huffy. He would come back. Of course he would. There was his cane in the corner. Here was one of his collars. He had left his light overcoat in the wardrobe. She looked about and tried to assure herself with the sight of a dozen such details, but alas, the secondary thought arrived. Supposing he did come back, then what? Here was another proposition nearly, if not quite, as disturbing. She would have to talk with and explain to him. He would want her to admit that he was right. It would be impossible for her to live with him. On Friday, Carrie remembered her appointment with Hurstwood and the passing of the hour when she should, by all right of promise, have been in his company served to keep the calamity which had befallen her exceedingly fresh and clear. In her nervousness and stress of mind, she felt it necessary to act, and consequently put on a brown street dress, and at 11 o'clock started to visit the business portion once again. She must look for work. The rain, which threatened at 12 and began at 1, served equally well to cause her to retrace her steps and remain within doors as it did to reduce Hurstwood's spirits and give him a wretched day. The morrow was Saturday, a half-holiday in many business quarters, and besides it was a balmy, radiant day, with the trees and grass shining exceedingly green after the rain of the night before. When she went out, the sparrows were twittering merrily in joyous choruses. She could not help feeling, as she looked across the lovely park, that life was a joyous thing for those who did not need to worry, and she wished over and over that something might interfere now to preserve for her the comfortable state which she had occupied. She did not want Drouet or his money when she thought of it, nor anything more to do with Hurstwood, but only the content and ease of mind she had experienced, for, after all, she had been happy, happier at least than she was now when confronted by the necessity of making her way alone. When she arrived in the business part, it was quite 11 o'clock, and the business had little longer to run. She did not realize this at first, being affected by some of the old distress which was a result of her earlier adventure into this strenuous and exacting quarter. She wandered about, assuring herself that she was making up her mind to look for something, and at the same time feeling that perhaps it was not necessary to be in such haste about it. The thing was difficult to encounter, and she had a few days. Besides, she was not sure that she was really face to face again with the bitter problem of self-sustenance. Anyhow, there was one change for the better. She knew that she had improved in appearance. Her manner had vastly changed. Her clothes were becoming, and men, well-dressed men, some of the kind who before had gazed at her indifferently from behind their polished railings and imposing office partitions, now gazed into her face with a soft light in their eyes. In a way she felt the power and satisfaction of the thing, but it did not wholly reassure her. She looked for nothing save what might come legitimately and without the appearance of special favor. She wanted something, but no man should buy her by false protestations or favor. She proposed to earn her living honestly. "This store closes at 1 on Saturdays," was a pleasing and satisfactory legend to see upon doors which she felt she ought to enter and inquire for work. It gave her an excuse, and after encountering quite a number of them, and noting that the clock registered 12:15, she decided that it would be no use to seek further today, so she got on a car and went to Lincoln Park. There was always something to see there, the flowers, the animals, the lake, and she flattered herself that on Monday she would be up betimes and searching. Besides, many things might happen between now and Monday. Sunday passed with equal doubts, worries, assurances, and heaven knows what vagaries of mind and spirit. Every half hour in the day the thought would come to her most sharply, like the tail of a swishing whip, that action, immediate action, was imperative. At other times she would look about her and assure herself that things were not so bad, that certainly she would come out safe and sound. At such times she would think of Drouet's advice about going on the stage, and saw some chance for herself in that quarter. She decided to take up that opportunity on the morrow. Accordingly, she arose early Monday morning and dressed herself carefully. She did not know just how such applications were made, but she took it to be a matter which related more directly to the theater buildings. All you had to do was inquire of someone about the theater for the manager and ask for a position. If there was anything, you might get it, or at least he could tell you how. She had had no experience with this class of individuals whatsoever, and did not know the salacity and humor of the theatrical tribe. She only knew of the position which Mr. Hale occupied, but of all things she did not wish to encounter that personage on account of her intimacy with his wife. There was, however, at this time, one theater, the Chicago Opera House, which was considerably in the public eye, and its manager, David A. Henderson, had a fair local reputation. Carrie had seen one or two elaborate performances there, and had heard of several others. She knew nothing of Henderson, nor of the methods of applying, but she instinctively felt that this would be a likely place, and accordingly strolled about in that neighborhood. She came bravely enough to the showy entranceway, with the polished and begilded lobby, set with framed pictures out of the current attraction, leading up to the quiet box office, but she could get no further. A noted comic opera comedian was holding forth that week, and the air of distinction and prosperity overawed her. She could not imagine that there would be anything in such a lofty sphere for her. She almost trembled at the audacity which might have carried her on to a terrible rebuff. She could find heart only to look at the pictures, which were showy, and then walk out. It seemed to her as if she had made a splendid escape, and that it would be foolhardy to think of applying in that quarter again. This little experience settled her hunting for one day. She looked around elsewhere, but it was from the outside. She got the location of several playhouses fixed in her mind, notably the Grand Opera House and McVicker's, both of which were leading in attractions, and then came away. Her spirits were materially reduced, owing to the newly restored sense of magnitude of the great interests and the insignificance of her claims upon society, such as she understood them to be. That night she was visited by Mrs. Hale, whose chatter and protracted stay made it impossible to dwell upon her predicament or the fortune of the day. Before retiring, however, she sat down to think and gave herself up to the most gloomy forebodings. Drouet had not put in an appearance. She had had no word from any quarter. She had spent a dollar of her precious sum in procuring food and paying carfare. It was evident that she would not endure long. Besides, she had discovered no resource. In this situation, her thoughts went out to her sister in Van Buren Street, whom she had not seen since the night of her flight, and to her home at Columbia City, which seemed now a part of something that could not be again. She looked for no refuge in that direction. Nothing but sorrow was brought her by thoughts of Hurstwood, which would return. That he could have chosen to dupe her in so ready a manner seemed a cruel thing. Tuesday came, and with it appropriate indecision and speculation. She was in no mood, after her failure of the day before, to hasten forth upon her work-seeking errand, and yet she rebuked herself for what she considered her weakness the day before. Accordingly, she started out to revisit the Chicago Opera House, but possessed scarcely enough courage to approach. She did manage to inquire at the box office, however. "Manager of the company or of the house?" asked the smartly dressed individual who took care of the tickets. He was favorably impressed by Carrie's looks. "I don't know," said Carrie, taken back by the question. "You couldn't see the manager of the house today, anyhow," volunteered the young man. "He's out of town." He noted her puzzled look, and then added, "What is it you wish to see about?" "I want to see about getting a position," she answered. "You'd better see the manager of the company," he returned. "But he isn't here now." "When will he be in?" asked Carrie, somewhat relieved by this information. "Well, you might find him in between 11 and 12. He's here after 2 o'clock. Carrie thanked him and walked briskly out, while the young man gazed after her through one of the side windows of his gilded coupe. "Good looking," he said to himself, and proceeded to visions of condescensions on her part which were exceedingly flattery to himself. One of the principal comedy companies of the day was playing an engagement at the Grand Opera House. Here Carrie asked to see the manager of the company. She little knew the trivial authority of this individual, or that had there been a vacancy, an actor would have been sent on from New York to fill it. "His office is upstairs," said a man in the box office. Several persons were in the manager's office, two lounging near a window, another talking to an individual sitting at a roll-top desk, the manager. Carrie glanced nervously about and began to fear that she should have to make her appeal before the assembled company, two of whom, the occupants of the window, were already observing her carefully. "I can't do it," the manager was saying. "It's a rule of Mr. Frohman's never to allow visitors back of the stage. No, no." Carrie timidly waited, standing. There were chairs, but no one motioned her to be seated. The individual to whom the manager had been talking went away quite crestfallen. That luminary gazed earnestly at some papers before him as if they were of the greatest concern. "Did you see that in the Herald this morning about Nat Goodwin, Harris?"
"No," said the person addressed. "What was it?"
"Made quite a curtain address at Hooley's last night. Better look it up."
Harris reached over to a table and began to look for the Herald.
"What is it?" said the manager to Carrie, apparently noticing her for the first time.
He thought he was going to be held up for free tickets. Carrie summoned up all her courage, which was little at best. She realized that she was a novice and felt as if a rebuff were certain. Of this, she was so sure that she only wished now to pretend she had called for advice.
"Can you tell me how to go about getting on the stage?" It was the best way, after all, to have gone about the matter. She was interesting, in a manner, to the occupant of the chair, and the simplicity of her request and attitude took his fancy. He smiled, as did the others in the room, who, however, made some slight effort to conceal their humor. "I don't know," he answered, looking her brazenly over. "Have you ever had any experience upon the stage?"
"A little," answered Carrie. "I have taken part in amateur performances." She thought she had to make some sort of showing in order to retain his interest.
"Never studied for the stage," he said, putting on an air intended as much to impress his friends with his discretion as Carrie.
"No, sir."
"Well, I don't know," he answered, tipping lazily back in his chair while she stood before him. "What makes you want to get on the stage?" She felt abashed at the man's daring, but could only smile in answer to his engaging smirk and say, "I need to make a living."
"Oh," he answered, rather taken by her trim appearance and feeling as if he might scrape up an acquaintance with her.
"That's a good reason, isn't it?"
"Well, Chicago is not a good place for what you want to do. You ought to be in New York. There's more chance there. You could hardly expect to get started out here."
Carrie smiled genially, grateful that he should condescend to advise her even so much. He noticed the smile and put a slightly different construction on it. He thought he saw an easy chance for a little flirtation.
"Sit down," he said, pulling a chair forward from the side of his desk and dropping his voice so that the two men in the room should not hear. Those two gave each other the suggestion of a wink.
"Well, I'll be going, Barney," said one, breaking away and so addressing the manager. "See you this afternoon."
"All right," said the manager.
The remaining individual took up a paper as if to read.
"Do you have any idea what sort of part you would like to get?" asked the manager softly.
"Oh, no," said Carrie. "I would take anything to begin with."
"I see," he said.
"Do you live here in the city?"
"Yes, sir."
The manager smiled most blandly.
"Have you ever tried to get in as a chorus girl?"
he asked, assuming a more confidential air. Carrie began to feel that there was something exuberant and unnatural in his manner.
"No," she said.
"That's the way most girls begin," he went on, "who go on the stage. It's a good way to get experience." He was turning on her a glance of the companionable and persuasive manner.
"I didn't know that," said Carrie.
"It's a difficult thing," he went on. "But there's always a chance, you know."
Then, as if he suddenly remembered, he pulled out his watch and consulted it.
"I've an appointment at 2, he said, "and I've got to go to lunch now. Would you care to come and dine with me? We can talk it over there."
"Oh, no," said Carrie, the whole motive of the man flashing on her at once. "I have an engagement myself."
"That's too bad," he said, realizing that he had been a little beforehand in his offer and that Carrie was about to go away. "Come in later. I may know of something."
"Thank you."